Hey, good morning to everybody. We'll be continuing today with the second half of our discussion. We started last week. We'll just start momentarily.
Sean, are you still there?
Still here.
Good.
Hey, Sean, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Okay. Good morning, Rabbi.
Cal, good morning. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good.
Right. So we were talking last week about the primarily about the Jews' acceptance at Sinai, apparently before they received the entire Torah, where they said, "We will do and we will listen." And we talked about the Talmud that cites a medrash, a metaphor in connection with this. And that is that when the Jews said this, so we know the number of the Jews was about 600,000. That was, again, just the token number, I should say, because that was just men above 20. That's not recording the, it's not including the men below 20, or the women, or the children. So when we say 600,000, it's just a reference to the whole nation. So the Talmud says that when they said that we will do and we will listen, and that seems to be in response to, according to Rashi, from Genesis until the event of Sinai, So Moses had read this all to them, which primarily is discussing the lives of the patriarchs, again from Adam, the creation, and Noah, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and his 12 sons. Had all the interactions that they had with God, and the perfected lives that they led, and the rejection of idolatry, and the acceptance of monotheism, and how they prayed, and sacrifices, you know, all the numerous perfections that they had. But again, that was only based on about 7 laws that they had. When the Jews heard this, so they accepted the system, and whatever else would come. That's what it means. We accept it, we will do, and we will listen. The second statement means that whatever we have not heard, we accept. And the Talmud states that at that point when they said this, so metaphorically, 600,000 ministering angels had given each person 2 crowns, one corresponding to the fact that they said we will accept, and one crown corresponding to the fact they said that we will listen, meaning future acceptance, even what they did not hear yet. When they sinned with the golden calf, right there at Sinai, so then twice the number of destructive angels came and took away both crowns. Okay, we discussed that a bit last week. And what we wanted to know was, one of the primary questions is, this is the only event that this took place, where there was such a an endorsement of the actions of the Jews, where they were giving crowns. And there is a dispute, as we said also, in terms of what the crowns were. Were they nice clothing? Were they literally crowns? Were they weapons of war? According to Sforno, it was more. It was not a a tangible object. It was their own, as he says, spiritual preparedness that preempted the receipt of the Torah on Sinai. As Sforno says, that they did not give away those crowns. What the Torah is referring to as edio, again, an ambiguous statement, and I guess that's purposely done. God is using, he's not using the word keser, which is the word for crown in Hebrew. God is not using the word Zion, which is a sword. He's not using beged, which is clothing, all the different views of the various rabbis. He's using the word edio, which leaves it very ambiguous. That's why there's such a dispute. There's a disparity amongst the rabbis as to what that refers to. But that itself has to be understood. Why is there an ambiguous reference to what God had told them now to take off from yourselves when they sinned by the gold calf? I mean, it says that they did not even put them on themselves, whatever it was, whether it was a crown or beged, but the edio itself, that's in 33, Exodus 33, verses 1 through 11. So the people didn't put them on after they heard that God was not going to travel with them. Because God says, if I do go with you, so then I'll consume you in a moment, meaning you'll be destroyed if I go with you. And we explained that last week. By the way, Doug, Cal, how's it sound?
It's just fine, Rabbi.
Yes, okay. Okay, so... Okay, and Beth, also thank you for confirming the sound is good. Okay, so what we said regarding that is that the, you know, Moses tells God later on, after the sin of the spies, that if you know, if you do not go with us, excuse me, if you destroy the Jews, which is what God had threatened to do in response to the spies, because the Jews also had fell prey to the council of the spies, and they collectively felt that they could not take over the land, in contrast to God's promise that you can take over the land. So they were their equation, their assessment of the situation, completely omitted God's complete omnipotence, God's complete ability to overthrow any inhabitant in the land. And they were completely terrified by the stories that the spies had communicated to them. And they were afraid for this great size of the people, because they said, we look like grasshoppers in their eyes. which of course is a projection, because you cannot know how they're viewing you unless they tell you that. So it was a mere projection that the Jews had out of their own fear. At that point, God was going to destroy the people, and Moses said to God that if you do destroy the people, this will now create a great shame in connection with your name. Your reputation in the world will be destroyed. Why? Because nations see that this cloud, this miraculous pillar-shaped cloud, always leads the people by day and the pillar-shaped flame at night. So they know that there's this miraculous relationship between the Creator and the Jews. And then if you destroy them, it shows that the whole plan, the mission, was a failure. So this cloud was indicative of the relationship, and that's what God is saying now, that when you're good, when you behave properly, so the cloud is with you, and it's an impression, it's a great, the nations of the world are impressed with you, because they see how such miracles are done on a daily basis for you, that you're led by God in your travels. But if the Jews sin, that very relationship would demand their destruction, because God is a just God, and if God doesn't destroy those who sin, so it would give a bad impression to the world. That's what Moses is complaining, you know, concerned about. So God says over here in 33, verse 3, that he will not go with the Jews for the very that very consideration, because he can't, if he has that close relationship with them after they sin with the golden calf, so then they would deserve destruction. So God says, I'll let you live by not having this close tie. Eventually Moses prays for the forgiveness and for God to go with them, and he does. Okay, but at that point, because they sinned with the gold calf, so God told them to, the people themselves didn't put on this edyo, whatever this edyo is, this crown or the garments, but God himself tells them not to put it on. And then the people do comply, again, in verse above, in verse number 6, that they vanquished themselves of those crowns that they received at Sinai, which is also called Horeb. So, I guess the two main questions that we still have to address are, number one, what was this, this singular incident that deserved these crowns, only one time in history, and this whole discussion of God telling them not to put them on, and the ambiguous approach to the reference to what these things are, these crowns. And it, I mean, usually when you have an ambiguous type of a, or a metaphoric type of an allusion to something, you speak about it once. The Torah doesn't go on, but here it's this three verses. It's Exodus 33, starting with 4, 5, and 6, all referring to this edyo. And it keeps on using the same term, and it seems like a real tangible type of an object. So we have to understand, if it really is, why was it such a dispute? For no one. One side saying it really was just their own spiritual preparedness that was referred to as crown. Even in that case, so why is it called a crown? Why is it referred to as such a tangible object? Right, you understand what I'm asking?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And, of course, also the first question, what is the unique nature of the event? When they say we will do, and meaning the whole Torah, even though they only heard the first fifth of the Torah, only the first book and a little bit of the second book, and they said also we will listen. Okay, so that's what we really want to address. The approach to how the Torah is referring to as the crowns, what these things are. If they're not really objects like Sfornos, so why is God telling them don't put them on, and the people themselves, they obey and they don't. And it says that they took them off, that they received at Mount Sinai. That's 33:6, where it says that. But that whole discussion, it sounds quite a tangible object. That's what it sounds like. The only thing is it's referred to very ambiguously. And the singular event also, I mean, what was so different? I mean, the Jews had followed many commands throughout history. While we're here, all of a sudden they're given these crowns. like Rashi says, that's back on 24-7. Exodus 24-7 is where it says that they receive them, that they say the words, we will do and we will listen. Okay, so those are the questions, and let's think about it for a moment. Let's hear your possibilities.
Rabbi?
Yes, Doug.
So with regard to we will do and we will listen, is the idea behind that because we recognize that Hashem is the creator, and so he commands us to do something, normally the approach it would seem in almost any other field of endeavor is that you learn something and then you do it, once you know the reasons behind it and so forth. Here, the reverse, is it an acknowledgement that because Hashem is the creator, I know that whatever he do must be appropriate, so I will immediately undertake the action, and then I will study to try to understand the meaning, the benefit, and so forth behind it, but not the other way around.
Right, I agree.
Acknowledgement of the creator himself.
Right, meaning once they heard a certain amount of the Torah, and they recognized the truth, again, from creation, through how God relates with man, and they see, you know, numerous generations where the people who live properly, they were protected even miraculously. And the nature was subservient to the person who followed the system. Of course, we have a principle that we do not rely on miracles. A person is not to do that. Even the greatest righteous people, like Jacob, he spoke to God and he said that he felt that his credit was minimized because of all the good that God had done to him. He didn't feel deserving. So a person, even on the greatest level, does not feel that he deserves, because again, our knowledge of God is just, you know, is so little compared to what the truth is. We just can't have knowledge of God. It's an impossibility. And even if what he does, again, it's a human knowledge. It's not complete at all. It's like a drop of, like one drop of water compared to all the oceans in the world, and even that is a bad comparison. So, but they saw this and they were impressed with the with the lifestyle of the righteous people, and they saw this relationship that existed between God and those people. So they had a certain element. I mean, they were not going in blind. So that would be Christianity or some other religion where there is just a complete, it's all built on faith. Judaism is not built on faith. Judaism is built on, we see the reality, we understand what the concept of a creator means. That we're clear about. And we see the proof. And we see the universe. And once I see that, then, like you're saying, Doug, they were convinced that the creator is just and is righteous, and therefore, not only will we do what those few commands, honoring the parents, setting up courts, and keeping the Sabbath, not only will we do that, but also we will accept upon ourselves anything that we are being told in the future that we don't know yet, because we have that trust, like you just said, exactly that. Right. So that is the unique nature of what took place over here. But now let's see if you can tell me, so why was this something which deserved these crowns? I agree with you, Doug. That's exactly what they did.
Well, is that so unique in the history of man that a nation would take that on, that they were given special crowns as a token of that?
Yeah. What was so unique? Let's see if we can try to boil it down to a description of this event, which by very nature of the description, it'll be incomparable. something incomparable definitely would deserve, then it would just follow that they would be given a crown just to underline that. That would just merely be a reference to the incomparability of that one-time event.
And the one-time event would be
when they
Sinai?
Said, no, when they said, we will do and we will listen. And after they heard just that first book, Genesis, and a little bit of the second one, and all the plagues and everything that happened in Egypt, up to Revelation, not including Revelation. So they accepted it before it was given, which makes sense. They willfully accepted the system after hearing a sampling of it, and they accepted it, and then there was a formal agreement made. Okay, you accepted it for yourselves and for all your future generations. Then the Ten Commandments were given, and then the rest of the Torah was given as it unfolded. But they accepted it up to that, at that point. And they, meaning what they heard, and for the future, they accepted the obligation. And keep in mind also, there were two crowns given.
Two crowns?
Right, there were two crowns. One crown corresponding to the words, we will do, and one crown corresponding to the words, we will listen. That was part of the Talmudic section that we discussed, that the angels came and they gave each person two crowns.
Well, are they are they reminders, if you will, of first of all, the commitment of we will do, which is the commitment to serve Hashem, and then the commitment of we will listen is the commitment to be constantly involved in the world of learning.
Agreed.
So in the same way that a mezuzah reminds a Jewish person of certain truths, were the crowns given as a constant reminder for those people, so as they got busy in their day-to-day work, they would be reminded of what those two major, I guess,
I hear you, the reminder. Well, according to Sforno, it wouldn't be a reminder, right? Because he says that these crowns are really just references to their own inner state of mind. So no angels really came. It really refers to, as you explained last week very well, your explanation I think was excellent, that it really represented their own inner perfection. That was really why they were able to make the statement, we will do and we will listen, and that's why it was one. It was the seat of a person's in the intelligence. It's one source that credits him with many good things. Whereas when a person sins, so there are numerous emotions that cause a sin. That's why when they sinned, and they lost the credit for both things that they said, it was due to divergent emotions. So that's why it means two destructive angels. Destructive angels mean instinctual drives. So it was when they lost the crowns, it means that when they no longer had that perfection, it was due to, another way of saying, you had two different destructive drives inside you, is to say two destructive angels came and took those crowns away from you. That's a metaphoric way of alluding to the fact that two different instinctual drivers was the cause of loss of a great level of distinction, meaning the crowns were the level of distinction. But there were no tangible crowns, there were no angels running around. Angels refer to the inner workings of a person. In this case. But according to the others, that they're real physical objects, then you could say, all right, then the concept of reminder, you could say. Let's go a little further and ask, what were the two perfections? Let's see if we could define clearly. Evidently, there were two major perfections that the Jews expressed, each one deserving its own crown. Let's see if we can isolate it. What was that? And again, it was in response to that they heard all the history of from creation through the Exodus. And they heard that just a few commands honoring the parents, setting up judges and courts, and keeping the Sabbath. One Rashi also says the red heifer was also another one. And what we said was that those commands, keeping honoring the parents, is accepting authority in terms of our initial stage in life, the parent. That's what's very important about that, but that's not the final target of the mitzvah. Then you have, as a person develops, they accept judges in the court system. So now the authority is in terms of following the Torah system, not just your behavior in the home. Finally, keeping Sabbath is acceptance of God as the ultimate authority, which the first two authority figures are really models for that we eventually transpose. So we first have to learn the concept of authority in order to finally transpose it onto to God. It says by King David's son, Adoniyahu, that he rebelled against his father and took the kingship for himself when it wasn't even given to him. And it says in the verse that his father never rebuked him. I think it says he was a good-looking child, and his father never grieved him, punished him for anything. And he took over the kingdom. And it says all that in one verse to teach you that there's a relationship, because anytime you have any number of ideas in a single verse, they are all related. So the way they're related is as follows: because he was a handsome child, so David was less likely to rebuke him as to others, because he didn't want to ruin the beautiful smile on such a handsome child. And because he never rebuked him, he therefore took over the kingdom. He'd never sensed any type of fear of authority. So you see that how essential it is, because he sinned with that. He ended up getting killed by his brother. But I believe, I'm sorry, I hope I'm not confusing the stories. We'll come back. But the fact was, it was a grave sin that he did. He was not given the kingdom and he took it. Now, this was all because he did not have rebuke. He never had the acceptance of authority figure, which shows us how essential it is of God's design, that we started out as infants and we have authority figures right away, because this is necessary to inculcate into our personalities the concept of an authority. Otherwise, we would be rebellious. And you see how the people before the flood came, where they were much taller and they lived longer, and all of that was really for their benefit, but they used it for their arrogance and the ego, and they took women from whoever they wanted. So it ended up that what God had intended for good, they used for their own egos. And again, you have another expression where, since there was no acceptance of authority, so a person rebelled. So this is why we have these three laws were given at this point, before they accepted the Torah. So they were told from Genesis through the Exodus, and they were given laws that all share the common bond of accepting an authority, because now they were about to accept the Torah system upon themselves. They were also given one other law, that was the red heifer, which is what they call a statute, a chok, something which apparent reason is not seen. Even King Solomon said there was he didn't understand. He said, "Behi rechokah mimeni, it is distant from me," meaning this idea. Not that the idea isn't there. Some people feel that the chok or a statute and Torah are laws that have no reason whatsoever. Maimonides is clear that every single law has a reason, which makes sense, because you would not have hundreds and hundreds of laws all so divergent from each other, completely with no objective in mind. No, there has to be a brilliant idea behind all of them. Just because we cannot see at the present time what that idea is, does not mean that God didn't put in it. He didn't imbue each law with great sensibility. But the fact, perhaps, that they were given a statute together, one statute together with those other ones before they accept the Torah, is also to the credit that once it's just like what they're saying, we accept what we see right now as being all the history from Genesis through the Exodus and all the forefathers and the matriarchs and all the ways that God had related and the miracles they had done, and we see this as being the life for man. And they said they also accept the statutes that we may not see necessarily the reason behind it. What are they saying when they say that? When they accept a statute that they don't see the reason behind it. And that's synonymous with the fact that they said, we will do everything we know now, and we will listen to what we don't know yet, and still do that as well. One idea here.
Is it the idea that we have seen enough that has convinced us that we are willing to trust whatever the Creator tells us to do, even though we don't understand it, because we have seen His works in His hand, and you know, we accept that He's the Creator of the universe?
Right, exactly. I believe that's exactly the point, Doug. That these two crowns are to credit the human mind in two capacities. One is in terms of what we do understand. That's why they said we will do. We see everything, and we'll do this. It makes sense to our mind. And that's what a crown is. A crown is something that's placed on the head. It shows the distinction of the person's intellect. But then when they said we will listen, it's like you're saying. That is to show another fundamental in terms of what a person must do. A person is not to say in his life, I will only do the mitzvahs or the commands that I understand. That's foolish. These Jews were on the right level, and they said, we see enough. Once we recognize that what we are accepting is the law from the only Creator, the one Creator of the world that is the source of all wisdom and justice, therefore, our minds are not going to be, you know, the buck stops here, that I must understand it first before I do it. No, just like a person is convinced of a doctor has a good intention, I don't have to know all the 10 years of medical school that he went through. I don't need to know all the terminologies and the practices that he memorized during his 10 years in med school. I trust the doctor because the mind tells a person that I cannot have all the knowledge in this area of medicine unless I, of course, practice and study. So certainly, when we're talking about God, the person cannot say, then no, my mind is, if it makes sense to me, that'll be the litmus test whether I move on and I follow this law or that law. No. See, a person it's a dual approach. That's what the two crowns are, I believe. That they accept intelligently, meaning a person uses their intelligence as far as possible. But then there's the conviction, like you're saying, Doug, once you see that what you're dealing here is with the Creator, now I know that he is the seat of righteousness and truth, and I see from what he's done, I am convinced that anything he will ever do, I am convinced of his nature to the point that it does not have to pass by my understanding. Even what I don't understand yet, I will still start doing now, and I'll still listen, and I'll do. So that is a necessary approach. See, if the person doesn't say that, then they're lacking a real conviction in terms of what God is. The real conviction, and this is the point, the real conviction in a person, in his understanding of what God is demonstrated when he, of course, knows that what he is responding to is the one God, not a false idea. And then when he even will put his life on the line. So there's many areas in the Torah where this is a demand that a person now makes a testament to his convictions in God. So if a person says in front of many people, I want you to bow down to this idol or I'll kill you, so you have to sacrifice your life. You have to demonstrate there's something greater than yourself, and I may want to live, but I recognize that the conviction in God and that demonstration to others far outweighs my puny existence. Here also the Jews said that we recognize that we don't have all the answers, but we have that conviction now. We have the conviction in what God is. So therefore, that demonstration is, in terms of that acceptance in the future, even though I have not heard 4/5 of the Torah, I haven't heard yet, nonetheless, I'm accepting it. And that's what it means also, that the commands that they received were just a few. Honoring parents, setting up the courts, keeping the Sabbath, that's all good. That makes sense. But they also accepted the red heifer, which most of them did not understand. But nonetheless, this is the command of God. That's it. It has to make sense. So those were the dual. That was the dual credit to those people, and that's what the two crowns were. So this also. Why did they get crowns at this point? Because this is now the, if we can give another reference to this event, the singular event. What was so singular about this event? I mean, you had many times in the past where individuals accepted God. Here was the first time, the one time in history where creation found its purpose. That's what was so unique about this event as well. Not as well, but that if we just rephrase what the credit is to the Jews, is that this is the whole plan of creating the earth and the animals and then putting man as the last creation, because now that the table was set, as the rabbis say, meaning now that all creation was done except for man, everything's now in the earth ready for man to now enter the world stage and utilize it to come close to God. And here they accepted it. Here was the pinnacle of success, the realization of the whole plan of creation was right at this point when they accepted it as a nation. So that was really the singular event over here. But the real perfection was in using their intelligence. See, that's really what it was. The perfection of creation is where they used their intelligence based on what they heard, and they expressed a conviction in God, expressed in the fact that they said, we're going to accept even that which we didn't hear yet. Okay, let me pause and see if there are any comments or questions.
Rabbi, in everything I've read, I've never heard anything that talks about how they agreed to this when they said, we will do and we will hear. Was it in unison? Did they have a spokesperson? I was just curious about how that took form.
I guess you study that part where it's 24/7.
Seems like they have 6 million people agree. What would that be like?
Yeah, if you look through, I'm not sure. It's a good, how do you actually view that event? Evidently, they communicated this to Moshe. Going to Ibn Ezra, Moses just read it to the elders, and they accepted it, I guess, on behalf of the people. The verse literally says that the people accepted it, meaning the people, the nation. So in 24/7, when Moses took the book of agreement, the treaty, and he read it in the ears of the people, and they said, everything which God spoke, we will do and we will listen. Right, and Ibn Ezra goes on and says that they spoke to the congregation, and they, I guess, put their hands, they placed their hands I guess it looks like the elders put their hands on the people, meaning, or the, it looks like here, but some physically ha'ed ashadehem. And they are corresponding to all of Israel. So they were speaking or listening on behalf of the Jews. Which is good, because they're the most intelligent ones. They're the ones that have lived the longest and have the greatest appreciation for the system. So that's according to Ibn Ezra. Doesn't say how many of there were, though. That maybe if you want to do some more research on that and see exactly how that transpired historically. That's not usually something that you have in the commentators. they would talk not more about how the physical event transpired, unless that was essential to the story. Here, the communication is that the people accepted the system before it wasn't forced upon them. The people heard a good part of it and they accepted it. And it says even in 24:3 that Moses came and told the people all the words of God, all of the statutes, and the entire people in one voice said, all the things which God said we will do. That's a little bit more descriptive. Right, that's 24:3. And what Rashi says they were referring to there was the commands of not being physically, not having intercourse, men and women not having intercourse for 3 days prior to the receipt of the Torah, evidently to remove oneself from more of an instinctual state of mind, because now they were about to receive divine commands. So they needed a state of preparedness. You don't just stop in the middle of the day and then, oh, here, God's giving me a Torah right now. No, there has to be a few days of preparing yourself. And the other law that they accepted, it says here, is to guard off the mountain. They had to rope it off, to put up boundaries, because there was a fear that they would go up and try to associate something physical with the event, which you see took place anyway when they made the calf. They miscounted, and that was the whole problem. They needed something tangible. Okay. But perhaps now we have one more question regarding the way the Torah in chapter 33 from verses 4, 5, and 6, and it talks about these crowns or, but in an ambiguous way, perhaps alludes to the fact that this very perfection, even though perfection of the person is not a tangible thing, but it's more, it's should be viewed as being the real essence of man, like a real tangible thing, like a crown. So, to underline how important this is, it's referred to. So if we go according to, like Sforno said, there was no real crowns given. Whenever you talk about angels, you're talking about something which is not really in physical existence, but it's alluding to something real. It's alluding to the perfections. Those angels that came and gave them the crowns, and they said the words, we will do and we will listen. Those angels really mean man's intelligence, those forces of perfection. That's the ministering angel that each person has. His own intelligence is what ministers to him. So when they reached that level and they said that we will do them, they expressed the conviction in what their minds saw as true, to what they grasp, and even what they don't grasp yet, we will do in the future. So that was two perfections. So that is such, that is, since that is the ultimate state that God created the world for and created man for, so there was a need to underline that and refer to it as a crown. So perhaps that's why the Torah refers to it in this way, that God is like telling them, take your crowns off, because how could, according to Sforno, how could he say that God is telling the people to take off a crown if there was no real crown? It's referring to the intelligence. But perhaps because this is the most crucial lesson, that the highest state that man had achieved as a nation at this point. So it's referred to, because when we say, you know, seeing is believing, so that's saying that the secular saying comes from a certain sense, that is, it is based on something, that people do refer to reality when they can see it. If they can't see it, you know, people talk about history. I wasn't there, I don't know, you know, I didn't see it myself, so. But people always want to know, how do you know that the whole thing of the Red Sea splitting is true? I didn't see it. And that's their argument. Although the very same people will agree that Caesar existed. They didn't see Caesar either. But when it comes to, you know, a system where they're obligated to keep laws, then they start rejecting, yeah, the splitting of the sea, who knows, the plagues, I wasn't there, I didn't see the miracles. Because if they do accept it, then they also have to accept the other miracles, which was revelation at Sinai, where the Torah was given. Now that means they have to keep the system. But the fact is that the reality over here, the ultimate state, even though it's not a tangible thing, the person's perfection, when you talk about human perfection, it's not a tangible thing, but since it is the most precious of all things, so it's referred to as the most prized of all objects, a crown. So God's referring to it, perhaps, in the Torah, in this tangible type of a fashion, in order to convey the nature of the value of this thing. It's the most highly prized thing, like a crown. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay. Even King Solomon does this. He says in Mishlei that the Torah, he refers to it as being like a necklace around the neck or a crown, meaning he refers to it as being a precious thing. You follow the Torah?
I'll read it to you.
It's always good when you have corroboration. At least I feel better when I have corroboration with something I'm suggesting. Okay, here he goes. He says, he refers to it in Proverbs chapter 1. And if you listen to the verse, he starts in 1:8. He says, "Listen, my son, to the rebuke of your father, and don't forsake the Torah of your mother. Because it will be adornments to your head and chains for your neck." So the head and neck respectively refer to your intelligence and your speech. The neck is the seat, the tongue, the throat. But you see, it refers to that as being a real thing. So here, too, you see an allusion to the perfection of the Torah when you accept it, that it's like an adornment to your head and your throat and your neck. So again, you see this idea. So perhaps that's exactly what's happening in this one case where God's referring to it as a crown. Because of being such the most prized element in man is when he reaches perfection, when he has the conviction and intelligence. So then we refer to it as a crown. He's as if he has a crown on. But it can't really refer to it as a literal crown because it's not. So perhaps that's exactly the approach that God uses over here when he refers to it as edyo, as a term that's ambiguous. Because we can't really say it is a crown because then people will think it is a literal crown. But it's not. The perfection that God's talking about over here is like the Talmud alluded to. It's the person's own ministering angel. And that refers to what? His intelligence. And now that they sinned with the gold calf, God says it's as if they had to take them off. That's what God's telling them. Take them off. Meaning you've removed your intelligence from yourself. As if I'm telling you to take off your crown right now. Right, so I think that addresses both questions that we started out with today. Make sense? Any questions?
I think we're good.
All right. All right, think it over. I guess if you have any questions, we could pick up next week with that. I'm not sure if there's more to go further here. You let me know during the week if there is. Otherwise, we'll see where we'll pick up for next week. Maybe let's see. All right, I'll have to think what we'll do next week. Don't have anything planned at this point.
Rabbi, wasn't there a point about that we made last week about Moses collecting the crowns and they were going to get them back later?
Yes, the Talmud goes on and states that when the Jews, the Talmud says after this, there's a couple of steps, I believe, four steps the Talmud has. First step is that the 600,000 ministering angels gave them two crowns each when they said, "We will do and we will listen." And when they sinned, 1.2 million destructive angels took them away. Then it says that a separate rabbi's statement was that at Mount Sinai they got the crowns, and at Mount Sinai they lost them. So it sounds like he's just repeating the facts. What I suggested is what he's telling you, a new concept. He's telling you that it was Sinai itself which caused the benefit and the loss, meaning it was a double-edged sword. The very revelation itself carried the danger. That's where the mountain had to be roped off, because with the fact that they're now going to hear and see a one-time miraculous event where God was going to communicate through Moses the law, now there's a danger of them feeling that there's something to this location, that we can go up the mountain. There's something in connection with God here on this mountain. Mountain had to be roped off, you know, lest they express idolatrous feelings and project some sort of a physicality in connection with God. And you see that they miscounted the day that Moshe said he was going to come back. They included the day that he ascended as being the first of the 40 days. So they finished the count of 40 too soon. And of course Moses didn't come back yet because they misconstrued it. So then they immediately made a physical object. Because of that state, that heightened state of a religious emotion, was a danger. So that's what he means. The rabbi was saying that at Sinai they got the crowns, and at Sinai they lost them. Meaning it was Sinai that carried with it the benefit, but also the danger. So that was the next part that got the Talmud. Then the Talmud says that Moses, he took all those crowns of the Jews, but in the future the nation will receive them again. Meaning in the future, once again, when God finally brings the redemption and he brings knowledge to the world, the Mashiach, the Messiah, and he imbues the whole world with knowledge of God. So then they will get their crowns back, meaning people will be living on the right level of intelligence again. The one thing we didn't answer, like you're bringing up, is that what does it mean that Moses took the crowns? We saw also that I saw yesterday, because we were reviewing this again yesterday, that there's one view that says that he stored them in the temple. He took them, but he put them into the Mishkan, the tabernacle. Because at that point, they didn't have a temple yet. They had the mobile, the tabernacle. So that's where he put all the crowns. So he said, again, that can't be literal, because how are you going to put in 1.2 million crowns in a small structure like that? So what we said was that perhaps it means that intelligence was now limited to those people who sought God in the tabernacle. And that's alluded to by saying that those crowns, which are a reference to human intelligence and perfection, they are now located only in the temple. So Moses had removed the temple from outside the camp of the Jews. That's what we read. So I think that explains the rest of that Talmud there. That's what it means. Moses took them. So perhaps being either that could be a responsibility that he has now all of the souls of the Jews in his responsibility, referred to as the fact that he took the crowns. There could be a couple of explanations, I'm sure, for that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, sure. All right. All right, so thinking over, if there's any other comments you have, we can just, you know, discuss it when we continue next week. And in the meantime, I'll look around and see what we'll do. Maybe we'll do, I'm not sure if we'll do Purim, since it's coming up. But until then, I wish everybody a good week. And we'll pick up next time, 11:15, same time.
All right. Thank you, Rabbi. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Have a good week, everybody.
You too.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, that'll wrap it up for today. We'll continue next week, same time. It's 11:15 Eastern Time. Until then, everybody have a very good week. Take care.